The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Hi, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 3 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. The title of this particular episode is going to be The Joint Illusion Cleaning House. So, since I started War Notes, this is a series in which I am making some suggestions and proposals on how to fix what is an irreparably harmed, hampered, and I would say severely handicapped U.S. defense system from stem to stern, from the top to the bottom, and something needs to be done. Somebody needs to clean house and get in there. So in the first two episodes, I laid out the framing of this particular house that we're building. In the second episode, I talked about strategic and operational frameworks and the way some kind of wholesale reassessment has to be done for America's place in the world. And I suggested, in order for the framing of what I'm going to propose in this episode and the other ones, when I tackle each of the services individually, what it's going to take to fix the inherent problems that the American Armed Forces have. I have identified one of those primarily being the actions of a global hegemon, not a regional hegemon. A hegemon in this case would be a power player in a region, or in this case, a planetary power player, that wishes to make the security environment as it perceives it neutral or beneficial to its own national security needs. And by the way, that perception doesn't necessarily have to mesh with reality, as we have seen time and time again since 1945, with America's pristine record of stalemate and defeat in all manner of military conflicts, at the price going now of approximately $1 trillion a year. And as I've told you folks who listen on a regular basis, you can't possibly know where you are if you don't know where you've been. So we have to figure out what exactly is joint and what does that mean. For those of you in the audience who happen to be military, I'll be telling you some things you probably know and a little bit of what you probably don't know. For those of you who don't have military experience or you haven't paid a lot of attention to what's going on a planetary level as far as the execution and use of American arms overseas, then maybe this will be something of a clarifying moment for you. I'm going to draw from some documents that were published by the armed services so that I can quite literally get it from the horse's mouth. So, American history reflects the importance of joint operations. Captain Thomas McDonough's naval operations on Lake Champlain were a vital factor in the ground campaigns of the War of 1812. The teamwork displayed by General U.S. Grant and Admiral David D. Porter in the Vicksburg Campaign of 1863, by the way, coincidentally, both Vicksburg and Gettysburg happened to have been satisfied to the Union forces' victory on the same day in 1863. And it's a great example of joint military planning and execution, not only because it happened, but because the doctrine wasn't in place to make it happen, and they did it on the run, which is quite impressive. However, confusion and lack of coordinated joint military action raised public criticism in the Cuban campaign of the Spanish-American War. By the turn of the century, war had become too complex for ad hoc joint planning to be successful. So after the Spanish-American War, which one could say was the second colonial expansion beyond the contiguous borders of the United States after the seizure of Hawaii in 1893, a joint board composed of the military heads of the Army and the Navy and the chief planner of each service was established in 1903. And let's keep in mind that for those of you who were in Uncle Sam's misguided children, the Marine Corps, the Marines have, for the most part, in the past 100 years, I think, been a direct subsidiary of the Department of the Navy. So the Joint Army and Navy Board was intended to plan for joint operations and resolve problems of common concern to the two services. Note, there is no Air Force, and note what I just said about the Marines. But the Joint Board accomplished little. Its charter gave it no actual authority to enforce its decisions, and thus denied the capacity to originate opinions. The Joint Board was limited to commenting on problems submitted to it by the secretaries of the two military departments. It was described as a planning and deliberative body rather than a center of executive authority. As a result, the Joint Board had little or no impact on the conduct of the First World War. So you'll note that there was no unitary advisement board on there that had the force of order or law for the military heads. So in other words, the Army and the Navy at the time could confer, but it didn't necessarily mean that one service would listen to the other in the conduct of operations at the same time in the same space. Now, after World War I, the two service secretaries agreed to reestablish and revitalize the Joint Board. Membership was expanded to six: the chiefs of the two services, their deputies, and the chief of war plans division for the Army and director of plans division for the Navy. More important, a working staff named the Joint Planning Committee, made up of members of the plans divisions of both services and staffs, were authorized. The new joint board could initiate recommendations on its own. However, the 1919 board was given to more legal authority or responsibility than its 1903 predecessor. World War I had informed that particular decision, although the 1935 publication Joint Action of the Army and Navy gave some guidance for the joint operations of World War II, the board was not influential in the war, and the board was officially disbanded in 1947. I'd like you to take note of something here, and you will note that with two services, instead of simply sort of suborning the Marines or maybe removing the Marines from the Navy and giving them an equal space at the table, and then in 1947 and 1948, the establishment of the U.S. Air Force, and until it fell under the Secretary of Transportation, the Coast Guard tangentially would be involved in these kind of operations. Another historical note, and one shortcoming that I hope would be remedied by the incoming Secretary of Defense, is that from 1805 to 1945, the Reichswehr and the Wehrmacht and the German Army, always at the OKH level, their general staff level, had military historians on staff full-time who had a charter, if not a portfolio, to review plans and advise and counsel the flag officers, or maybe even field grade officers at that time, on any relevant history that one can draw from the past. Because remember, in the military profession, we have this almost 2,500-year-old bloodless practicum. Bloodless for us, the readers, not necessarily those who participated in the conflicts that are chronicled in said history. But nonetheless, to me, I think it goes without saying that that's something that you should have on board. The historian positions traditionally in the U.S. and the West are not historian positions that advise and counsel on planning or the conduct of the armed forces, but historians acting as diarist and archivist for the conduct of campaigns. Distinctly different from the intellectual heavy lifting that one would get from learned military historians on staff. Now, we go back to World War II, and soon after Pearl Harbor, that would be December 7th, 1941, Roosevelt and Churchill at the Arcadia Conference in Washington established the Combined Chiefs of Staff as the supreme military body for strategic direction of the Anglo-American war effort. But the U.S. had no established agency to furnish U.S. input to such a committee, and the British Chief of Staff Committee, on the other hand, had long given effective administrative coordination, tactical coordination, and strategic direction to British forces. And much like the Germans had done the very same since 1805, the British Committee had planning and intelligence staffs to coordinate the war effort, as well as serving as a corporate body for giving military advice to the War Cabinet and the Prime Minister. The collective responsibility of the British Committee was set by the Prime Minister in 1924 and given to each new member as a directive. Now, in response to the need for coordinated staff work, the concept described by Admiral Leahy, who was the naval advisor to President Roosevelt, they had been close friends for a very long time, as a unified high command, was adopted by the United States in 1942. That group came to be known as the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. This first Joint Chiefs of Staff worked throughout the war without legislative sanction or even formal presidential definition, a status that President Roosevelt believed preserved the flexibility required to meet the needs of the war. The first members of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff were the opposite numbers to the British Chiefs of the Army, the Navy, and the Royal Air Force. In this case, it would be the Army Air Force in the U.S. side. Admiral William D. Leahy, as I mentioned, Roosevelt's special military advisor with the title of Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, General George C. Marshall, Chief of Staff of the Army, Admiral Ernest J. King, tough son of a bitch, Chief of Naval Operations and Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Fleet, and General Henry H. Arnold, Deputy Army Chief of Staff for the Air and the Chief of the Army Air Corps. Now, each member was promoted to five-star rank in December 1944 when the grades of General to the Army, General of the Army, and Fleet Admiral of the United States Navy were established. The Arcadia Conference also gave formal definition to the terms joint as involving two or more services of the same nation and combined as applying to organization plans and operations of two or more nations, such as allies and coalitions. Under Roosevelt's leadership, the JCS steadily grew in influence and became the primary agent in coordinating and giving strategic direction to the Army and Navy. In combination with the British Chiefs of Staff, it mapped and issued broad strategic direction for both nations. At the end of World War II, the need for a formal structure of joint command was apparent, and the wartime Joint Chiefs of Staff offered a workable model. The first legislative step was the passage of the National Security Act of 1947, which formally established the Joint Chiefs of Staff and laid the foundation for the series of legislative and executive changes that produced today's defense organization. The most recent reorganization was in 1986 with the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which also birthed Special Operations Command. Then, of course, we have the former Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, Dwight Eisenhower, who by 1952 becomes the President of the United States. Now, as a result of that, he came into clean house, quote, "I know better than any of you fellows about waste in the Pentagon and about how much fat there is to be cut, because I've seen these boys operate for a long time," end of quote. And of course, you can take that quote today and apply it equally to the behavior of the Pentagon a mere 60 years later. By the way, this is long before Space Force, and the Commandant of the Marine Corps and the Chief of the National Guard Bureau did not have seats on the Joint Chiefs in 1953. Additionally, the role of a Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs would not come into existence until Goldwater-Nichols Act of 1986. So, in early 1953, the Joint Chiefs were comprised of their chairman, the uniform heads of the Army, Navy, and Air Force having to come into being in 1947. Thus, it was that the head of the Navy, the Chief of Naval Operations, then Admiral William Fletcher, was the only member of the team who reasonably expected to serve well into Eisenhower's first term. Then there emerged the Civilian Secretariat of the Army, the Navy, and the Air Force, and they were told to order the new nominees in Washington, D.C. ahead of their confirmation hearings. Eisenhower wanted to confer with the nominees to ensure that they would be supportive of his Great Equation program and hence his defense reforms and accompanying cuts. Twining, who was also naturally supportive of the direction Eisenhower wanted to go, was confirmed in his role in June of 1953. Radford arrived from Honolulu in July and began to backbench Bradley in meetings of the National Security Council to get a sense of where Eisenhower was going strategically. He picked up the importance of balancing the domestic economy with national defense needs quickly and backed Eisenhower. Now, what you discover here, especially with the product, they called it the New Look Military Strategy, And what that new look military strategy, mind you, this is 1954, 55, significant cuts to the Army and Marine Corps, and to a lesser degree the Navy, while plussing up the Air Force. Not surprisingly, the heads of the Army and Navy quickly rebelled. Both Ridgway and Kearney pushed back on the assumptions underlying the new look in their public congressional testimony. Eisenhower reacted strongly, quote, "By God, this has got to stop," end of quote, he told a staff member. "These fellows like Kearney and Ridgway don't yet realize that they have a boss." Both men were dismissed after only 2 years of service in their respective roles. Ridgway was replaced by General Maxwell Taylor, and Kearney by a very junior Rear Admiral Arleigh Burke. Arleigh Burke, of course, is the last successful hull that the Navy put to sea in 1991, in my opinion. And what a tremendous fighter, and I'm glad that we have a destroyer named after him. Civilian control of the military was really important, and of course, this is the time in which the strategic focus was on the year of maximum danger because of George Kennan's long-haul containment strategy that he had crafted. And everybody during this time were flirting with different ways to play with the force structure. This would be the time when they had the pentatomic divisions, where atomic warfighting at the tactical and operational level was entertained as a real-time way to conduct war in the 1950s, along with the blossoming of the jet age and a number of other innovations that were made during that time. Now, one thing that I really appreciated about digging into Eisenhower's strategic realignment of the forces is that he changed the force structure of the military to support the new strategy that he had that was very missile and atomic centric. He cut 500,000 men from his 1.5 million man army to pay for expanding the Air Force's bomber fleet, while simultaneously creating an entirely new ICBM force from scratch. He also drove through a modernization of the Navy, sacrificing 100 ships from the nearly 1,000 vessel fleet to pay for new nuclear power plants, a new class of supercarriers, and nuclear-tipped missiles carried in an entirely new class of submarines. So to the extent that Eisenhower pursued a hidden-hand management style, as was entertained at the time, one scholar did say his handling of the Joint Chiefs revealed that it was an iron hand. And so he did a lot of force structure, noodling, recreation, new weapon systems at the end of World War II, in this case, nuclear arms and such, the new realignment planet-wide, and what was necessary for force projection and things like that. And while one may walk away from this thinking, well, Eisenhower, what a war hawk, for the most part, he was not. Having been a sober general officer during World War II, a mere 7 years after the end of that war, he becomes the president of the United States. He was conspicuous in not getting America involved in foreign conflicts to include refusing French pleas for assistance in Vietnam. Of course, that would go on to haunt presidents that would succeed Eisenhower, who took the bait and tossed themselves into the briar patch of Southeast Asia. So there's the history, because not much changed, apart from being involved in wars that America lost between the end of the Eisenhower era in 1959-1960 and the succeeding wars that America lost on a consistent basis. And then we fast forward to 1986 with the Goldwater-Nichols Act, which did a complete realignment of the deck chairs on the Titanic, as it were, the Titanic in this case being the Pentagon, and gave us the Special Operations Command, along with another few innovations and permutations on how to organize the forces. But then, of course, that was a result of both 1979 and 1983. In 1979, there was the Botched Hostage Rescue, which took 7 to 8 years, thus in 1986, to come up with the Special Operations Command so that we would not have had or replicated the disaster that occurred during that botched hostage rescue mission that was made by Jimmy Carter, the president at the time, 1979, in the Iraqi desert, and then fast forward 4 years to Reagan's botched effort in Grenada and the bloody mess that that was as far as the forces themselves talking to each other. And mind you, This is since the end of World War II. This is since the Korean War. This is 8 years after one has been out of Vietnam formally, even though formally it was 11 years when all combat forces came out of Vietnam from an American perspective in 1972, accepting advisors. And then in 1983, the tiny island of Grenada is invaded. A joint forces there, of course, Navy and Army and Marine Corps have to cooperate together. They can't talk to each other. They can't coordinate fires. They can't synchronize efforts. They can't get their logistical trains in tow. They can't get anything on time where it has to be. Fortunately, it happened when one was fighting several hundred Cuban soldiers on a tropical island and wasn't an existentially painful loss like one would see in the early days of World War I or World War II, where American forces would get a very substantial shellacking going against near-peer and peer forces. Special Operations Command SOCOM is created. It is headquartered just north of where I live in Tampa, Florida, alongside Central Command. These commands, NORTHCOM, CENTCOM, SOUTHCOM, which is South America, PAYCOM, UCOM, the U.S., being the hubristic imperial power that it is, divides the world into these unified commands under which it can lord by taking military forces and combining them with task force organization, which is a fancy way of saying, what do I need to achieve this specific mission in this period of time? That would be task force organization, something that the Germans took to a high art in both World War I under the Reichswehr and World War II under the Wehrmacht. And, of course, most rational militaries in the West paid attention to the things that worked for the Wehrmacht despite their odious political leadership. Yet, even under this renewed and revamped and rejuvenated joint configuration, America continues to lose wars. As a matter of fact, as I mentioned before, a sterling and unrivaled reputation and stalemates and defeats since 1945 that remains at a very stout zero. So there's the history and a fast forwarding of where we are in a relative apprehension of the facts at hand. And what it means is that it is critical for the Americans. And when I say that, by extension, we're talking about the West because we're talking about NATO, Pacific allies, whoever they may be. So think when I'm talking about these things, the effect it will have downstream to allied and coalition forces that we normally work with in near-peer and peer forces, not third world forces. Colonel Douglas MacGregor, you may have seen him speaking. He never made flag rank. I think he never made flag rank, much like Colonel John Boyd, because he was too brilliant for his own good. And unlike the British, who win all of their military victories in spite of their best efforts, when it comes to out-of-the-box thinkers and mavericks and unorthodox folks and the way they apply their martial imagination, not acceptable in the present framework of how the post-World War II, I would say post-Vietnam War military works, because it is curious that all the flag rank means those with stars on their uniforms, such as generals and admirals. There's some very curious things that happen to get to that point. Number one, you must be political. Number two, you must be very adept at Machiavellian intrigue, palace whispers, knife fighting campaigns bureaucratically, and worst and best of all for them, but worst of all for us as the country that subsidizes the military that fights, a absolute zero tolerance for risk. In other words, risk aversion. Because in order to make the flag rank, not only do you have to be familiar with the people who have flag rank already, if one is on the incipient cusp of being promoted into those august halls, but you also have to have an officer efficiency report, an officer performance report history that is absolutely flawless. Can't make mistakes, can't have any evident failures, can't have learned from said failures and mistakes and have that there. Hence, the kind of people, for the most part, that are predisposed to become flag rank officers tend to be politicians more than combatant commanders, and they tend to be folks who are very risk averse, which I might ask you, even for those of you who have never been in the military, do you want military commanders to be risk averse, or do you want them to make rational risk assessments and make the moves that they have to for success on the battlefield? So again, Colonel Douglas McGregor, you've probably seen him speak. I think that he's done a great job in the last 2 years describing with much more accuracy than the mainstream or coprophile media exactly what's going on, for instance, in the special military operation that's being conducted by the Russians against the Ukrainians, and what an absolute disaster that entire enterprise has been done for the United States. I've mentioned in the past on excursion podcasts and things where I think it is extraordinary, and I would love to look back in time to see if I can find an historical analog where a peer competitor, in this case the U.S., with another peer competitor, in that case being Russia, that peer competitor, in this case the U.S., would show its hand with all of its emerging technology and exquisite platforms by giving it to the country that is fighting against Russia in this case, so that the Russians, unlike what one would hear about them being tired and not tactically or operationally innovative, which is not the case at all, that they wouldn't be taking notes on the exquisite platforms, they wouldn't be changing their tactics, techniques, and procedures, they wouldn't be altering their strategic mixing, they wouldn't be modifying the way they synchronize fires and putting metal on target, they wouldn't look at all of these sensors and effectors that have been fielded by the U.S. and the West in an active battlefield in the Ukraine, and they wouldn't be taking notes in order to discover how they could best the West? Well, that's apparently not the case. If you are listening to this, you know that a week or two ago, we saw a very innovative variation on the Rods from Gods, where Oreshnik, Russian Oreshnik IRBMs or ICBMs, that would be intermediate range ballistic missiles or intercontinental range ballistic missiles, were lobbed that had conventional warheads on them. Well, guess what? Since the 1950s, ICBMs have been a hypervelocity munition since the 1950s. Hypervelocity in this case means that they exceed Mach 5. In these cases, maybe they exceeded Mach 7 or 10. But what that means from a physics perspective is that when you have a conventional munition, Rods from Gods was this science fiction concept where one would have these 6-inch thick, maybe 9 to 12 foot titanium rods in space, where you would simply unlock them and drop them so that once they assumed a very high speed, in this case hypervelocity, and all of a sudden that velocity was arrested by hitting the ground, the bleeding off of the energy would cause a non-nuclear strike with no radiation that was quite catastrophic in the damage that it could do. And that damage, of course, would be a matter of the density and throw weight of the munition itself. And what we see with this, the Oreshnik, this latest variant that's been employed by Russia, is they're having rods from gods that aren't fixed in space on platforms from which they can be released, but they're simply using the parabola dynamics of an IRBM or an ICBM missile to lob it, and then at apogee, it comes back to Earth, releases, and with apparently very good accuracy, can land on something and then, of course, bleed off the energy rather violently once it reaches terminus. Not only does the U.S. and the Allies not have anything like that in the current military inventory, this has been like a hurricane among defense ranks as far as where the heck did this come from. Now, I would urge everybody who gets a chance, and I'll put this in the show notes, to read Arthur C. Clarke's 1950s short story called Superiority. And the abstract for that short story is that you have two galactic empires battling each other. One is very scientifically sophisticated. The other one uses brute force. And the scientific sophistication is such that they keep on saying, well, at the margin, and the next time, and the next version, we're going to get it better and better and better. Well, in their yen to perfect said technology, instead of being satisfied with an 80 or 85% solution, they continue to do that until the other empire wins them over through simple brute force. I think to a certain extent, that could be what happens in the future with America. So on November 14, 2024, Douglas MacGregor released a paper at the Ron Paul Institute called Navigating the Fiscal Storm, A New Course for U.S. National Defense. And I wanted to go through this with some ideas that apply to what I'm trying to get at as far as fixing the joint illusion that we all suffer under in the U.S. now in the Pentagon. He says the incoming president has three choices. Allow service bureaucracies or external events to drive outcomes, resulting in few to no savings. This is akin to letting the ship drift aimlessly at the mercy of the storm. Number two, make marginal adjustments to the defense status quo, avoiding conflicts, but achieving little change and only modest savings. This is like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. It won't save the ship. He is very concerned not simply with taming the warfare state, but also taming the expenditures that are going on. And by the way, that is something that is just a little bit outside the left and right barriers of what I'm going to be discussing today, so I'll tease at that, but maybe we'll handle the fiscal crisis and austerity crisis that is coming down for the Pentagon in a future episode. And number three says, leverage the fiscal crisis to reduce overhead, streamline defense investment, and reset the force structure, increasing capability and promising major savings. This is the bold course correction needed to navigate the storm safely. And in this case, MacGregor's apprehension of this storm is that our near peer and peer foes, in so many ways, whether it's fire synchronization, whether it's robotics, whether it's the use of conventional munitions with IRBMs and ICBMs, whether it's ship-killing missiles, whether it's submarine advances and diesel electric, whatever the case may be, America, despite spending $1 trillion a year on its military, is in a very real hazard about being outclassed and defeated in yet another near-peer or peer war that emerges on the horizon in the 21st century. I love this next paragraph from MacGregor because it sort of riffs off of Colonel John Boyd's Patterns of Conflict, in which when I was a young soldier, I was trying to wrap my head around what does strategy mean? And Boyd came up with this very simple explanatory framework for what it is and what strategy is and grand strategy when one talks about the political military parameters is that one fosters alliances and isolates enemies. I say again, foster alliances and isolate enemies. Now, the rub for that is in order to foster alliances, you better have a past history of sticking around when things get hard. And America, since 1945, doesn't have that reputation internationally. MacGregor goes on to say, quote, grand strategy, if it exists at all, consists of avoiding conflict, not starting wars. New thinking in defense and foreign policy prioritizes diplomacy and peaceful cooperation over military power. End of quote. You will note that for over 2 years with the special military operation of Russia into the Ukraine, I have been baffled by the fact that the West and its NATO allies have almost done everything in their power to stymie diplomatic solutions to that conflict. It always appeared to me that the rational and adult thing to do was to rent some very nice office space in Geneva, Switzerland, with some teak tables, conference tables, cater with the finest refreshments and meals, and send some diplomatic intellectual heavyweights there and have them tap their fingers on the fine teak with an invitation out to all parties on all sides to come and talk, because there's nothing wrong with talking. He goes on, none of America's potential opponents, except those with nuclear weapons, pose a direct threat to the American homeland. If international terrorism and criminality remain threats, then border security and tightly controlled immigration should be the top priority in national security. Senior military leaders and their services cannot be expected to reform themselves and fundamentally change the military status quo. A World War II Cold War structure that is expensive, single-service focused, and vulnerable to weapons of mass destruction. Peter Drucker, when asked how to change a large business enterprise, answered, quote, "If you want something new, you must stop doing something old. People in any organization are always attached to the obsolete." End of quote. And I would add Chesterton's fence to this, which means that if you do take down a fence, always figure out the reason that the fence was put there in the first place. Quote, "In line with Drucker's guidance, the incoming president must implement a new national military strategy that diverges sharply from the last 30 years. And mind you, I'm quoting McGregor here. I would say the last 50 years. This strategy must scale back America's forward presence, mandate adaptations to new forms of warfare, and address the requirement to retain and develop America's best human capital in uniform." End of quote. Well, that goes without saying, but it's very hard, especially in the DEI environment that I hope is going to perish with the new administration, to really have that kind of high-performance human capital. But nonetheless, mandate adaptation to new forms of warfare. For those of you who are new listeners, and for those of you who are old listeners, just have patience with me going over this. But remember, we are in new revolutions of military affairs now in the 21st century, and America has not caught up. America hasn't caught up to robotics. America hasn't caught up to autonomous targeting. America hasn't caught up to hypersonics in defense and offense. And of course, with the new Russian adaptation and use of the IRBM, ICBM, with conventional non-nuclear warheads, this is yet another variant in which America and the West has been caught flat-footed. Because not only does America have very insufficient numbers, those numbers would be 44 for mid-course interceptors, for incoming IRBMs and ICBMs, America has spent approximately $10 billion. I talk about this at my blog at the Libertarian Institute. $10 billion and hasn't found a solution set yet for hypervelocity munitions, whether those are offensive munitions on offensive platforms or defending oneself against a hypersonic munition coming and intercepting it before it lands in your lap. McGregor goes on, "For real and meaningful reductions in the current $1 trillion national defense budget to occur, national command authorities must alter the nation's strategic focus. New national security legislation must move the posture of U.S. forces away from military interventions focused on nation building, democratization, or alleged threats. Instead, the defense posture should focus on the Western Hemisphere, learning to avoid patterns of behavior antithetical to U.S. interest." Now, end of quote. Remember what I've been talking about, whether I have hinted at it in previous episodes or talked about it directly as I have in two episodes, which is that America needs to take a knee, America needs to reassess, America needs to reframe when it comes to its military posture planet-wide, and whether America likes it or not, whether it's fiscal austerity or the sheer mismanagement and chaos avalanches of military incompetence that has so informed everything the United States has done militarily, why can't we take a strategic pause? Why can't we do this reassessment where not only do we prioritize defense over offense, I just told you about 44 mid-course interceptors in the U.S. inventory, $1 trillion a year, and they give you, for the defense of the nation, 44 mid-course interceptors. Those of you who are engineers know that when it comes to shooting, or artillerymen, or missilemen, know that when it comes to shooting an incoming object, especially one that is going in excess of Mach 3 to 5, you don't send one missile, one interceptor up after it to get a PK above 90%, a probability of kill above 90%. You must send, depending on what it is, 2 to 4 of them. Let's go with 4, which means that if 11 missiles are inbound, you're going to send 4 missiles up, and you will have exhausted your kinetic magazine inventory for defending the country from IRBMs and ICBMs. I happen to think that this is an epic strategic failure on the Department of Defense not to take the second word in their title seriously, and they haven't for the longest time. Now, I've been reading McGregor's mind, or McGregor's been reading my mind, but he and I are one. He has these following 5 points, which are the foundation for a new national military strategy. Defend America first. Reserve the use of American military power for defense of the U.S. in the Western Hemisphere. Yes. Number two, maintain strategic military power. Ensure U.S. freedom of action in areas of strategic importance by preserving and enhancing America's core capabilities. Okay, I have some reservations about that. My reservations are this whole thing of being able to project power is pretty much old hat now in the 21st century, and it is becoming more and more problematic. As we have witnessed in the Ukraine, for the first time in human history, when it comes to the lone infantryman, or his fire team, or his squad, or his platoon, whether he's a Marine 0311 or a U.S. Army 11 Bravo, it has gotten to the point now where the Lancets, generations 1 through 3, that the Russians are employing, they will take a $50,000 minus Lancet and use that to take out a single man in the field that they identify, or a group of them in a fire team or a squad with said munition. Nothing like this has ever occurred in human warfare before. This is brand new, and it has to be tackled, wrestled, and dealt with, and find solution sets to make it so that our soldiers aren't in the existential hazard that they happen to be now because of the lack of technology to mitigate that, or tactics, techniques, and procedures to mitigate it. Number three, declare a no-first-use doctrine for nuclear weapons. I love this, and a lot of Americans are shocked, but there was a first-use doctrine for nuclear weapons in the 1970s and 80s because of the formidable size of the Warsaw Pact forces in Europe, when Europe and the Fulda Gap were the major areas of concern for the American military. As a matter of fact, if we had a no-first-use policy that was stipulated as we speak, we would not be in this very curious kerfuffle we are in, where before the new president comes in for his term and inauguration, January 20th, we seem to be flirting and skirting with nuclear world war with Russia. It just astonishes me that we're here. Number four, establish an operational national defense staff. Develop, update, and implement a refined, unified command plan to dramatically reduce unneeded overhead and improve the U.S. Armed Forces' responsiveness to national command authority. This action requires legislation to place a chief of defense in the chain of command with real authority, not just advisory. End of quote. Imagine that, a chief of defense at the Pentagon? The Pentagon being forced by statute to consider defense, its first and foremost, the defense of the homeland, its first and foremost duty? Shocking. And lastly, build new armed forces for the 21st century. And I've talked about that in the past because I am so concerned with the fixation and almost habitual romance that the American defense community, and of course, by extension, military defense contractors have with exquisite platforms. Those could be sophisticated bombers. It could be sophisticated IRBMs or ICBMs. It could mean U.S. carriers, and those of you who aren't aware, I consider the carrier to be the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. And the sooner we take these future fish apartments out of the inventory, the better. Because, and I will cover this in much more depth when I talk about Navy improvements that could be made in another episode, but whether we like it or not, surface fleets are becoming very problematic in the 21st century, and by the end of the century, nearly all naval warfare, I would suggest, will be subsurface. McGregor goes on, and he starts to talk about the Russian strike fire reconnaissance complex, and I devoted an entire episode in Chasing Ghost in an excursion podcast to the Russian strike fire reconnaissance complex, so I will make sure that I put that in the show notes and give that a listen, so I won't bore you with it again here, but they have broken the code on putting metal on target. The U.S. and its NATO allies have not. As a matter of fact, quote, Russian Integrated Air Defense Systems, IADS, shot down roughly 35,000 drones, 647 aircraft all types, and 283 helicopters. Russia's tight integration of ISR, intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, with strike weapon systems, artillery, rockets, missiles, and aircraft-delivered bombs. As a matter of fact, I want everybody in my audience to familiarize yourself with the argo of artillery in a 21st century sense, which means that artillery will be not only dumb rounds coming out of conventional gun tubes like 155s or 105s and such, but it will be all things that originate on the ground that in a parabola strike either a air target or a ground target. They're responsible for 870,000 casualties of an estimated 1.8 million Ukrainian casualties. The numbers of Ukrainian dead probably exceed 600,000. Meanwhile, in less than 3 years of combat, the Russian military sustained 120,000 casualties, including 75,000 soldiers killed in action. End of quote. I'm not certain where he didn't footnote this, so I don't know where the citation is for that, but I do believe it. Then he goes on, quote, open disbelief in the possibility that the Russian ISR strike complex could defeat masses of armor and aircraft resulted in repeated battlefield failures, costing the lives of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian soldiers, end of quote. Of course it did, because here's what one has to remember. If you have been a bird in the cage and you've never left that cage, you don't know what the hell your wings are for. In this case, America and the West has been struggling with system after system, everything from the integrated combat systems to JADC2 to ABMS, the air battle management system and such. They're all in the experimental stages. There is no working joint synchronization complex for fires in the U.S. inventory. Shocking, I know. Nor do the NATO organizations have something like that. He quotes Eisenhower saying, quote, separate ground, sea, and air warfare is gone forever, end of quote. Amen. And I wish that we could put that in font 220 at the end of every very expensive teak desk in the Pentagon. Now, this is a lengthy document, and I would urge all of my listeners who are interested to read this document from the top to the bottom, because it's got a lot of great information in it. So, quote, in the meantime, Army end strength and Marine end strength should be reduced to 430,000 and 120,000, respectively. The two services must be viewed as components of the larger ground force, and their roles and missions must be redefined by informed civilian leadership. Because, by the way, if the Marines don't have competent and usable maritime connectors to reach a contested beach and have the firepower to reach that contested beach under the assistance of naval gunfire, which doesn't exist any longer, and they're doing it from a gator fleet that is aging in such a way where it is unreliable to a very large extent to actually get them over blue water to said contested beach. He goes on to talk about the U.S. Navy, Marine aviation, and then he says something very curious where he says, direct the reduction of the Navy surface fleet to 8 carrier battle groups from 11. I would take that to 0 immediately tomorrow morning if I could for those future fish apartments. Like the Marine Corps and the U.S. Army, the Navy and the Coast Guard are moving closer together in terms of mission profile, so they could be blended seamlessly. Aerospace forces must also cope with the new challenges. And clearly, the service secretaries will require flexibility to redirect any identified savings. Yeah, I'll wait for that to happen. He says nuclear weapons remain unchanging necessities for national defense until some new breakthrough in technology renders them obsolete. End of quote. I would tell you that what we need to do is get rid of the terrestrial-based ICBM, IRBM fleet. We need to get rid of the B-52, B-1B, B-2, F-117, which is now retired, and the B-21 bomber fleet, and those atomic and conventional weapons, and scale them back considerably in order to concentrate on submarine-launched ballistic missiles, which now and in the future will be the only way to assure that at least they have a chance of not being tracked. And one can imagine what the savings would be if that occurred. And I love this particular quote, quote, today's senior military leaders and their forces are living within the organizational structure of the 1947 National Security Act, a paradigm for strategic military action rooted in the World War II experience. Reshaping the bloated warfare state to defend America first demands the elimination of wasteful and redundant single service overhead and support structures. This is not a new problem. During the 1944-45 advance from Normandy to the Rhine, General Montgomery's headquarters controlled only two armies, which in turn had only two and three corps respectively. And the corps operated only two to three divisions, sometimes even only one. The ratio of headquarters was no more economic in the U.S. Army. B.H. Liddell Hart noted that the abundance of headquarters was one reason why the Allied advance across the continent to Berlin was so protracted, despite plenty of transport and understrength German ground forces without air cover because the Luftwaffe had been defeated 4 months earlier. At the height, this is a quote, at the height of World War II, when there were 12 million men in the United States Armed Forces, 7 four-star generals and admirals commanded them: Marshal MacArthur, Eisenhower, Arnold, King, Nimitz, and Leahy. How many four-stars are there currently commanding today's armed forces? 43. 43. Now, he has a graphic in this document where he says a proposed reduction of 43 four-star to 11 four-star positions. I'm all about this. For instance, he has the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the vice chairman. They would be the chief of defense and the chief of the National Defense Staff. And then he goes on the line of Chief of Staff U.S. Army, Naval Operations Air Force, and all the rest. He reduces those to a reform where you would have ground forces, maritime forces, and air, missile, and space defense forces. Of the commands, Northern Command, Southern Command, Central Command, European Command, Indo-Pacific, and Africa, he reduces those to Northern, Southern, Atlantic, and Pacific. And of the Strategic Transportation, Special Operations Command, Space Command, Cyber, he has the U.S. Strategic Operations Command with Soft, Space, Intel, Cyber, a Strategic Support Command, which would be Logistics, and a Strategic Deterrence Command, which would be the Nuclear Forces. I love these ideas. And I think that even if these ideas aren't rock solid, these are ones that we have to aspire to, because the aspiration gets us out of this bloat that is occurring in the DoD, where you have so many four stars to do absolutely nothing constructive for the military moving ahead except to preserve their bureaucratic dominance. And I found this funny too. He says, quote, in a perverse way, the expansion of general officer headquarters overhead follows Boyle's gas law, also referred to as the Boyle-Marriott law. When contained, gas will always expand to the limits of the container. So will headquarters and the flag officers that they serve. End of quote. And then he goes on, the point is to reduce, then replace the senior ranks. All appointments to 3 or 4 stars should be temporary, with the understanding that the serving general officer will retire with the rank, benefits, and retired pay of a major general. That was the standard before World War II, and it should be reinstituted. So what MacGregor is referring to here is not only a streamlining of the leadership, but smaller forces, and I'm all aboard for these reductions. Here's another quote. As the force grows smaller, the standards of performance, mental, and physical fitness should not rise, not fall. No one who is unfit to deploy should be retained on active duty. I repeat, no one who is unfit to deploy should be retained on active duty. To the extent that it can be done, the National Guard or Reserve should mirror the active force. Whenever possible, retired or disabled veterans should fill administrative posts on military reservations. What should be done to rectify what's wrong? First, if forces must become smaller, they should also become better. There is no point in recruiting substandard people. Recruiting must become more personal and permanent. Stationing of specific units near or where the recruits live must be considered. Enlisted ranks and warrant officers should be able to invest in housing near the locations where the formations in which they serve are permanently stationed. All formation ships, air wings, should have identified home garrisons to which they return after completing deployments. Officer careers will be subject to a different set of expectations given career development demands. But other ranks and their families must be given a more stable life. Reserve and National Guard units should, if possible, partner with active duty units. When sailors, soldiers, airmen, or Marines leave the force, they should be encouraged to join the Guard and reserve partner units. These relations must be cultivated and strengthened. For every 3 years of honorable service, service members should receive 1 year of exemption from federal and state taxes, regardless of the length of time they serve. 9 years provides 3 years of tax-free living. 21 years of service provides 7 years of freedom from state and federal taxation. This policy should incentivize Americans with the desire to build businesses to serve for a minimum of 3 years to receive one free tax year. End of quote. So I like a lot of these ideas. Now I'll have to let some of these bounce around inside my head to see if I'm fully on board with them, but I want the new thinking to occur. I want the new reimagining to occur. And in conclusion, what he says is that, quote, during his presidency, Eisenhower's goal was to achieve both security and solvency. The developing fiscal crisis creates the opportunity for Washington to both economize and develop the nation's range of strategic options in military affairs. Unfortunately, Washington's decisions since 1991 to employ military power were often made without an accurate and sobering self-assessment of America's strength and its weaknesses. Given his experience during World War II, Eisenhower was very hard on service parochialism, realizing that the service chiefs viewed themselves as first being accountable first and foremost to their own service. He insisted that the service secretaries stand firmly behind the Eisenhower administration's defense program, even though it might not fully meet any service's desires. End of quote. So I will have that in the show notes. I urge you guys to take a gander at it and see what you think. I'm on board with most of McGregor's prognostications. When it comes to joint warfighting, despite the fact that we have entertained joint as a conceptual relationship among all the respective services in America and by extension NATO when coalition and allied operations are conducted, it is not done well at all. 1983 in Grenada, disastrous. SOCOM is created in 1986. It has created a massive bureaucracy in SOCOM that I think at last count employed 77,000 people, of which less than 10% of those were trigger pullers and operators and special effectors. And of course, that includes all of the special organizations, tier one organizations like CAG and SEAL Team 6 and the 26th Special Tactics Squadron, now the Air Force and such, and whatever MARSOC is contributing at the time. Bureaucracies, in the end, especially government bureaucracies, create conditions in which it isn't the mission of the bureaucracy to achieve the mission in their charter and portfolio, but to maintain and expand the power that they have to hire and not fire, and expand that power even over other bureaucracies and not achieve their missions. Because, by the way, if they achieve their missions, one would think, logically speaking, they would have to be dissolved. But when was the last time you ever saw that happen? So in the end, to me, as the title would suggest for this episode, The Joint Illusion, I do think it's an illusion. I don't think that America's armed forces coordinate fires well, for instance. They don't synchronize fires. They don't synchronize them at the joint level. And all of the times over the past 50, 60 years, but I'll just reflect on the past 20 years when it comes to IBCS, ABMS, look up those acronyms if you wish, and JADC2 and the use of artillery fires and air fires and the coordination. I mean, the closest I can come to that kind of organizational synchronization would be some of the special operations campaigns in Afghanistan, Iraq, and other places where you had those really STRAC and well-muscled Air Force CTTs who could come in there with their 140 pounds of kit and line up as combat air controllers. Everything the Air Force, the Navy, and the Marines and Army rotary wing could throw into the mix. And once they had a targetable portion of land, they could bring the hate in by directing them, as they're all standing in line skyward, to come in and annihilate parts of the ground. Those synchronization fires worked well. But remember, those synchronization fires worked well against a foe that did not have navy, did not have artillery, did not have any sophisticated weapon systems whatsoever. It was not a near peer or peer environment. And in a near peer or peer fight, what America is going to encounter is they may have their GPS denied. They may have their ability to synchronize fires denied because if they don't move, counter-battery fire will destroy whatever sent rounds downrange in a hasty or deliberate fashion. The remainder of this century will require joint synchronization. And of course, when one thinks of synchronization, you would think that that's the whole idea of joint operations, is it not? That you want to capitalize on all the talent stacks in these respective services so that you could bring them together so hopefully the sum of all those battlefield modalities will be so overwhelming that they could win fights. But America can't do that yet. We will continue in this series. So we have completed the introduction, the strategic and operational framework, and by extension, the grand strategic framework in episode 2. We discussed the need for not only joint synchronization and a reimagining of the Marshall joint venture in the 21st century in the U.S. and with the Allies, but what's going to happen in increasingly fiscally austere environments where you genuinely may have to cut the fat, and there's a lot of fat, from that $1 trillion U.S. Pentagon budget. So, as you may have seen from the announcement that I made several days ago, I have suspended recording the Chasing Ghosts podcast for the remainder of this calendar year so that I can concentrate on completing this series before the inauguration, because what I'd like to have done is I would like to have I would like to have this entirely wrapped up and a nice bow tied to it so that I can have the entire series complete that proposes the reimagining, the revitalization, and the emergence of a much more scaled back, muscular, thinking man's war organization in the U.S. that takes defense of the homeland first and then assigns itself to doing all the things it has to do as a regional hegemon. So with that, check the show notes for the materials that I mentioned. I so appreciate your solicitude and listening. If you want to get in touch with me, you can write me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. And if you happen to be listening to this on your favorite podcast vendor of choice, I'd love for you to leave a positive review, whether it's stars or a narrative, whatever the case may be. Again, thank you for listening. This is Bill, out.